4374, Project 30078.
This is a black and white film now stored in the National Archives. It was recorded in 1953 at the military's Nevada testing site in the Great Basin Desert west of Utah. You can see the faint outline of mountains on the horizon. It's the middle of the night. Then you can hear a countdown over a loudspeaker. Here you can literally hear the radiation pulsing through the camera. A massive white flash reveals a mushroom cloud billowing upward, illuminating the desert floor. It takes a full 28 seconds for the sound of the blast to hit. The U.S. military performed over 1,000 of these types of atmospheric and underground nuclear weapons tests for nearly half a century during the Cold War nuclear arms race until 1992. World leaders urged the U.S. and other nuclear powers to stop nuclear testing as the long-term harmful impacts were realized. Tens of thousands of downwinder victims in Utah suffered cancer and birth defects. In 1996, the Worldwide Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was opened for signatures, but the United States has never ratified it. Well, this is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. A few weeks ago, U.S. Undersecretary of Arms Control Rose Gottmuller was in Utah and spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. She spoke about the future of America's nuclear weapons arsenal. But first, to introduce her, Utah State Representative and Democratic Minority Leader Jennifer Selig and former Republican Representative Ryan Wilcox introduced the Undersecretary. In 2010, Selig and Wilcox co-sponsored a resolution in the Utah House of Representatives calling on U.S. lawmakers to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty.
I came to know the Undersecretary during the effort in 2010 to ratify New START, an arms control treaty which was negotiated by Undersecretary Gottmuller and which, I might add, was the first strategic arms reduction treaty ever negotiated by a woman. Pretty amazing stuff, huh? Seriously. Former Representative Ryan Wilcox and I have worked on several nuclear weapons and testing issues over the past years, and such bipartisan cooperation is rare. So in Utah, if you all don't know, the minority in the legislature are the Democrats and the majority are the Republicans. Former Representative Wilcox was with the Republican Party. In this case, Ryan and I, however, were motivated by Utah's history as suffering the direct consequences of nuclear weapons testing. We were determined to put aside partisanship and do what we could to create a world free of the dangers that Utah's downwinders have lived through and currently live through. Our efforts were bolstered by the passionate statements of former Utah Senator Jake Garn, who has eloquently argued for a permanent ban on nuclear weapons tests because it will strengthen, not weaken, U.S. national security interests. I've really enjoyed working with the Undersecretary in 2010. So earlier this year, when she was nominated for her new position, it was a very easy decision for me to do what I could to urge her confirmation. As a board member of Women's Action for New Directions, or WAND, and a member of the Women's Legislative Lobby, I wrote letters, made phone calls, and asked my representatives in Washington to vote to confirm the Undersecretary in her critical new role. Before I turn the mic over to Mr. Wilcox, I would also like to thank HEAL Utah for their participation in this event. The Undersecretary has gone from St. George all the way up to Weber and has had quite a visit. I also want to thank the Hinckley Institute and the University of Utah for helping put together this event to engage you all in discussion related to critical global issues that shape our world. Many of you are already familiar with the Undersecretary, but for those who are not, Mr. Wilcox will share her bio. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. It's good to be with you here today. As many of you know, we're here to hear from Undersecretary of State Rose Gottmuller. Before I turn the time over to her, I want to tell you a little bit about this extraordinary woman. As you know, she's the Undersecretary of State for both arms control and international security. The Senate confirmed her earlier this year. As Undersecretary, Gottmuller advises the Secretary of State on arms control, nonproliferation, and disarmament, topics to which she has dedicated her long and esteemed career both inside and outside of the government. Prior to this role, she was the Assistant Secretary for Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance, where she was the lead negotiator for the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, New START, that Representative Selig just mentioned. Ms. Gaudemiller was the first woman to ever negotiate a strategic arms reduction. Among other things, we should all be very grateful for her efforts in the 1990s in removing nuclear weapons from both Ukraine and the other former Soviet satellites, Kazakhstan and Belarus, when she was on the National Security Council staff. She's held leadership positions with the Department of Energy, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, the RAND Corporation, the Council on Foreign Relations, and has taught at Georgetown University. I'm thrilled to welcome her to Utah today and the Hinckley Institute, Undersecretary Gaudemiller.
Wow, it's a huge honor to be here today at the Hinckley Institute, and I'm just delighted to have this opportunity to talk to you about a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and that is the future of U.S. nuclear weapons policy. And in particular, I want to concentrate on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. So thank you again to Jennifer and Ryan for the introduction. It's been great working with them for now several years, and really been a wonderful opportunity to think about the future of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty again here in a state where this issue means so much. So let me just start by saying I'm the State Department's lead for arms control and nonproliferation. What's that, you ask? What does that mean? I know that a lot of people don't spend a lot of time thinking about the bomb. We worry about Afghanistan and our troops coming home from Afghanistan. We worry about the Ebola crisis in West Africa. We worry about the threat of terrorism around the world. But bombs, don't think about it every day. They're not in the news cycle. And I do think that that's a good thing. But there are still thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons in the world and lots of after effects of the Cold War nuclear buildup. I think nobody in this country knows about that better than you here in Utah. Over 2,000 nuclear explosive tests took place around the world until a moratorium was put in place in 1992 by President Bush. About half of those tests the United States conducted. As many of you know, 928 nuclear explosive tests were conducted at the Nevada test site, now known as the Nevada National Security Site. This included 100 above-ground nuclear explosive tests. These above-ground tests, the purpose of which was to improve the effectiveness of our nuclear arsenal, had the consequence of distributing radioactive fallout downwind of the test site. Over time, radioactive and cancer-causing particles, such as strontium-90, found their way into milk and other food products, eventually ending up in the bones and teeth of children. Beyond the multiple radioactive hotspots in Utah, hotspots were detected throughout the West and as far away as the East Coast. Growing public concern about the dangers of nuclear explosive testing during this period collided with another major event in our post-World War II history, and that was the Cuban Missile Crisis. As one step leading us back from the brink of nuclear war at the time of that crisis in 1962, President John F. Kennedy called for a complete ban on nuclear explosive testing in 1963. The conclusion of such a treaty, President Kennedy said, so near and yet so far, would check the spiraling arms race in one of its most dangerous areas. It would place the nuclear powers in a position to deal more effectively with one of the greatest hazards which man faces in 1963, the further spread of nuclear arms. It would increase our security. It would decrease the prospects of war. 51 years later, we are still so near and yet so far from this goal. We were able to achieve part of the objective through the limited test ban treaty that was negotiated, ratified, and put into force in 1963, a remarkable record. It banned tests in space, in water, and importantly, in the atmosphere. However, the further spread of nuclear weapons remains a threat, and we still lack a total ban on nuclear explosive testing. Although the United States signed the CTBT in 1996, the Senate in 1999 failed to give its advice and consent to its ratification. At that time, there were two issues that were of concern to the Senate. First was our ability to maintain our nuclear stockpile without nuclear explosive testing, and the second had to do with the monitoring and verification of the treaty. Today, the situation is much, much different 15 years later. As Secretary of Energy Ernie Moniz said last month, there was a time when an active and robust United States nuclear explosive testing program was necessary, but that time is more than 20 years in the past. Since President Bush put in place the nuclear test moratorium in 1992, we have not conducted a nuclear test in this country. Last month marked 22 years since the United States last conducted a nuclear test. Today, the Department of Energy's Stockpile Stewardship Program, which is a suite of experimental, diagnostic, and supercomputing capabilities, allow us to model and simulate nuclear devices without nuclear explosive testing. With this program in place, the directors of the Department of Energy's National Security Laboratories affirm the safety, security, and effectiveness of our current nuclear stockpile every year to the president. In fact, they believe we actually understand more now about how nuclear weapons work than they did during the period of nuclear explosive testing. The ability to monitor and verify compliance with the CTBT is also stronger than it has ever been. The International Monitoring System, the heart of the verification regime, was really just a concept 2 decades ago. Today, it is nearly complete. It is a technically advanced global network of sensors, including 35 stations in the United States. These sensors can detect even relatively low-yield nuclear explosions. My boss, Secretary of State John Kerry, recently referred to the IMS as one of the great accomplishments of the modern world, and it is truly an international partnership of countries working together to deploy the sensors around the world. In addition to its verification role, the IMS has also proven its ability to contribute already critical scientific data to benefit civil society. Since the Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami back in 2004, the IMS has contributed considerable seismic data to the Pacific Ocean Tsunami Warning System. Additionally, after the Fukushima nuclear crisis, we saw how the IMS can track radioactivity from nuclear reactor accidents. It was fascinating for me. A year and a half ago, I was in Vienna, where the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization is located, and one of the IMS sensors for radioactivity is on the roof of that building, about 22 stories up overlooking Vienna. So I went up there, very windy day, you know, it was a day like today in the fall, very windy, went up there and saw how the system was deployed and operating. And they said to me that they had detected within 10 days of the Fukushima nuclear reactor accident that cloud of radioactivity that had been moving around the Earth, moving around from Japan in the prevailing winds, moving eastward to Vienna. So very sensitive radioactive detection capability, also part of the international monitoring system. And it's already providing that kind of capability and data for nuclear reactor accidents. The on-site inspection regime of the CTBT verification regime has advanced significantly as well. In the next few weeks, U.S. experts are going to participate in a large-scale integrated field exercise sponsored by the CTBT organization, hosted by Jordan. I will be going to Jordan also as an observer at that exercise, seeing firsthand the formidable technology and expertise the international community can bring toward short notice to investigate the site of a suspected nuclear explosion. All told, the issues that the senators were concerned about in 1999 are being addressed, and we have a chance to look at closing the door on nuclear explosive testing forever. Indeed, I would argue that it is much in our interest to do so.
That's U.S. Undersecretary of Arms Control Rose Gottmuller speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on October 22nd. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back.
Today, America's nuclear deterrent remains safe, secure, and effective. That is thanks to the heroic efforts of the airmen, sailors, and Marines who, despite sometimes insufficient resources and manpower, stretch themselves to maintain and guard and protect and operate the nuclear enterprise every day. However, the internal and external reviews I ordered showed that a consistent lack of investment and support for our nuclear forces over far too many years has left us with too little margin to cope with mounting stresses. The reviews found evidence of systematic problems that, if not addressed, could undermine the safety, security, and effectiveness of the elements of the force in the future.
That's U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel speaking last Friday. The Pentagon plans to spend an additional $10 billion in coming years to fix problems of neglect and mismanagement with America's nuclear forces. If you're just joining us, this is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. And today, we're airing a talk given several weeks ago at the University of Utah by U.S. Undersecretary of Arms Control Rose Gottmuller, who spoke not only about the need to better manage America's massive nuclear arms arsenal, but also the need for the U.S. to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, or the CTBT.
Plain and simple, the CTBT is good for U.S. and international security. It is a key part of leading nuclear weapons states toward a world of diminished reliance on nuclear weapons and reduced likelihood of a nuclear arms race. An enforced CTBT will make it difficult for states without nuclear weapons to develop advanced nuclear weapons capabilities. And an enforced treaty will also make it hard for states with more established nuclear weapons capabilities from confirming the performance of advanced nuclear weapon designs that they have not tested successfully in the past. Because of this, an enforced CTBT will constrain arms races on a regional basis. These constraints will be particularly important in Asia, where states are building up and modernizing nuclear forces. With the national security benefits of the treaty in mind, President Obama called for the ratification and entry into force of the CTBT during his famous speech in Prague in 2009, and he has been calling for it regularly ever since. Now we need to make sure that people know what the CTBT is and why it is important. It has been many years since we have brought this treaty before the American public, and they don't really, you know, remember what it's all about. I can say, however, that in 1999, when the treaty was up for ratification of the Senate by the Senate before, 85% of the American public supported the CTBT. So now we have to bring it before people like you so that you have a chance to make a judgment for yourselves, ask questions, understand about the importance of this treaty for U.S. national security, and then be able to begin at a grassroots level to move the issue up into the public consciousness. The most important thing that people can do as supporters of the treaty is to educate their friends, their family, and their communities on the reasons that the treaty is good for America. Two people who have been doing that right here in Utah are in the back of the room, and that is Jennifer Selig and Ryan Wilcox. And I'm really just delighted to have the chance to work with them on this important project. On March 8, 2010, the Utah House of Representatives unanimously passed a resolution urging the U.S. Senate to give its advice and consent to ratification of the CTBT. The resolution, H.R. 4, was introduced by Democratic Representative Selig and co-sponsored by Republican Representative Wilcox. In addition to noting the security arguments for the treaty, the non-binding Utah House resolution and the floor debate recognized the health effects suffered by Utahns and other downwinders who were exposed to fallout from nuclear explosive testing in the past. The work of Jennifer and Ryan is important, in my view, for two reasons. First, it's critically important that Americans understand the nuclear threat and how they can help. You all have a huge say in the future of this nation's security, and it's important for you to make sure that your voices are heard. Ryan and Jennifer made sure that Utahns had a voice in this debate. Second, and just as important, is something that Jennifer already referred to, They cast aside party affiliation and worked together on an issue that was important to all of their constituents, an all too rare occurrence these days. They should be commended on their partnership. I do commend them on their partnership, and I hope that they can serve as an example as we expand the dialogue on CTBT to states across this country. It's a discourse that and a dialogue that we're starting here in Utah, but I really see an opportunity to expand it across this country to many states, and to have that quality of discussion and debate will be very, very important. So, with an emphasis on open dialogue rather than a timeline, we are working with the Senate to refamiliarize senators with the treaty. A lot of CTBT-related issues have changed since 1999, and the Senate has changed a lot since then, too. It's up to us as policymakers and experts to practice due diligence in consideration of this treaty and make sure all the issues are out there for people to discuss and debate. Ratification of this treaty will require debate, discussion, questions, briefings, hearings, trips to the lab, thousands of questions perhaps from all over the country as people want to understand what's going on. And when I think about this, I really think about the kind of serious process that we had for ratification of the New START Treaty back in 2010, when my team and I answered over 1,000 questions for the record, because the senators, too, had a very serious interest in understanding the deep implications of the treaty for U.S. national security, and that's a good thing. That kind of open discussion and debate is very, very important to our national system. So senators should have every opportunity to ask questions until they are satisfied. That is how good policy is made and really how treaties get across the finish line. We are confident that we have a good case to make. As President Reagan's Secretary of State, George Shultz, said, senators might have been right voting against CTBT some years ago, but they would be right voting for it now. Utah's own former Senator Bob Bennett actually came up with what I thought would make a nice Twitter hashtag when he said to me last May, "I'm converted on the issue of CTBT ratification." But we have a lot of work to do in the weeks and months ahead. This is a worthy goal to pursue, but it's going to take some heavy lifting. An enforced CTBT will, though, we are convinced, benefit the United States and indeed the whole world. So with that, I will wrap up and be ready to take your questions. I really am very, very pleased to be here at the University of Utah on this beautiful fall day and at the Hinckley Institute. By the way, as I close, I just want to give one advertisement. You already had an advertisement for the internship program here at Hinckley, but I hope you'll also consider the State Department internship program, which is a very important program for bringing students from all over the country to Washington to work for the summer, or in some cases a semester, if you have a Washington semester program. So urge you to be looking at State Department internship programs also, not in any competition with Hinckley, but simply as another option for you. And if you're interested, now is a time to be looking at the state.gov website about internships, because we'll start the process of selecting for next summer within a very short period of time. So anyway, thank you all very much for your attention and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
We will devote the remainder of our time to questions from the audience, so please state your name into the microphone and something about yourself.
Hi, thank you so much for coming to speak today. My name is Nisha Kavalam, and I'm studying social work with a minor in political science. And you mentioned a little bit about radioactive fallout, and I was wondering if you could speak to the demographics of the population that's living in those areas affected by the fallout, and what CTBT is doing to have that part of the conversation.
Well, I think it's a very good question. Obviously, the 100 atmospheric nuclear tests that I spoke about took place in the 1950s. I did begin this trip, as was mentioned, on Monday of this week down at Dixie State in St. George, and the southern part of the state I know was very seriously affected. So it was something that directly affected your grandparents, in some cases your parents, if they were living in the state at that time. And I had some very moving stories told to me, actually, when I was in St. George by people whose grandparents or parents had been affected by either serious problems with cancer, and there were some people there who were cancer survivors, or who had actually had direct economic effects on their ranch land, on their flocks of sheep and herds of cattle. So it had, I would say, two kinds of effects, one on the health of the population, the other on really the economic situation of the population and the health of the farming and ranching community in the areas where there are hotspots around the world. So, I mean, around the state. Actually, it does affect around the world, too, because another thing that has been extraordinarily moving for me in recent years is to have had the opportunity to go to the Semipalatinsk test site, now in independent Kazakhstan, but when that was part of the Soviet Union, that's where the Soviet nuclear tests took place. And you know, the Kazakhs that I talked to told very similar stories about the stories that I heard down in St. George. They said, "We didn't know what was going on." You know, one man said to me, "I was a young man, and I was out playing in my village, and suddenly, you know, there was this bright light and mushroom cloud, and you know, this dusty stuff started raining down. We had no idea what was happening to us." And he spoke very movingly to a conference there in Kazakhstan and saying, of his village, he was the only survivor, and he was by this time an old man. So it is a problem that affected populations in, you know, different parts of the world, particularly between the two Cold War rivals, Russia, Soviet Union at that time, and the United States, but now has effects, downwind effects, but also down generation effects in terms of you know, ability for that population to even return and inhabit that territory which has been contaminated. In the case here in Utah, people spoke about, of course, having to deal with cancer clusters in their families. But again, it is something that I am very glad we were able to put the atmospheric test ban in place in 1963, because it halted that atmospheric testing and the serious effects that came from it.
So why do you think that Israel hasn't signed on? And what can be done to get them on board? In looking at the different nations who haven't agreed to it, that's kind of one that stands out as interesting.
Well, let me say, first of all, that 183 countries have signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, among them Israel, and 163 have ratified the treaty. Now, like us, Israel has not ratified the treaty, but it's one of the states that must ratify the treaty in order for it to be brought into force. And let me say just a few words about that. I am emphasizing now that we, the United States, need to move out on ratifying this treaty for a couple of reasons. One is the national security benefits that I talked about. Another is the human health and economic consequences of the treaty, another very important reason to get it into force now. But a third is the fact that we've had this moratorium in place since 1992. We've not tested weapons for 22 years. This international, it's an informal moratorium. It has actually held very well, with just a couple of instances like India and Pakistan tested in 1998, for example. But generally speaking, the moratorium has held very well in all of these years. So the question is, why shouldn't we be getting the benefits of a legally binding treaty that would bring with it this very extensive monitoring and verification regime? Why should we continue basically to deal with an informal moratorium when we could have the benefits of a legally binding verification regime in place? And then we would be certain to have opportunities to investigate on an international basis any suspected incidents of illicit nuclear testing. So there are some important, you know, reasons out there, but I would like to say that among the states that must ratify the treaty for it to enter into force are included the United States, China, Israel, North Korea, Iran, Pakistan, and India. So this is a very difficult group of countries, you'll recognize, for, you know, entering into this treaty. Actually, I don't think we're so very difficult. We're actually very responsible players in the international community. And indeed, I talked about the way that investments are going into the international monitoring system. The United States is the country that puts the most investment internationally into the international monitoring system. So we're very responsible in the way we go about supporting this treaty regime already, despite the fact that we have not yet ratified it. But my view is that we should lead the way, that others will follow. I know from talking to the Chinese that they will follow us. I say to them, hey, don't wait for us. You don't have to wait around for us to ratify. Go ahead and do it. But so far they haven't responded to my advice. But in any event, I do think that when we ratify this treaty, it will have an enormous influence on these other countries, and I know it will bring China along quickly. If we get down to the point where it's only North Korea that hasn't ratified the treaty, that's a good problem to have, in my view, in terms of exerting, pressure on them to move forward with what they will need to do to return to a good stature with regard to the nonproliferation regime and the denuclearization of the North Korean or the Korean Peninsula and North Korean territory. So there are many steps to go through, but I do think it's both important but also urgent for us to move out with our own ratification process.
I think it's pretty easy to make the case for the CTB as being, you know, good for America, but in terms of from an international perspective, why should other countries be willing to give up their ability to kind of have their own self-determination for their security? Because a lot of other countries don't have the infrastructure necessary to do digital modeling, especially when we talked about how Ukraine had disarmed, and it's quite clear that the U.S. isn't willing to really move in to protect all of that country's assets.
Let me talk a little bit about the Nonproliferation Treaty. Most countries around the world, in fact, the vast majority of countries around the world, have decided in signing up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty as non-nuclear weapon states, that nuclear weapons do not actually serve their security. And so I think it's wrong to be thinking narrowly about nuclear weapons as being some kind of absolute guarantor of security. In fact, in this day and age, concern about nuclear weapons in the hands of terrorists are that concern is what is driving President Obama to push for steady, step-by-step elimination of nuclear weapons toward a world without nuclear weapons, because he said, if terrorists get their hands on nuclear weapons or fissile material, we will have an enormous threat to the international community that will simply be undeterrable. And so we shouldn't be thinking of nuclear weapons as some kind of absolute guarantee of security. In fact, I think that they have many attributes of the opposite effect. So we look for other ways to supply security to countries. And I'll talk about just the way I think about extended deterrence, which is the guarantee that we extend to our allies in the NATO alliance and also to our allies, Japan and South Korea. We talk about extended deterrence as involving very capable conventional weapons, as involving missile defense, as involving very capable command and control systems. And yes, nuclear weapons at this time are part of that extended deterrence capability. But in the end, as the president has said, they can actually be a detriment to security, and particularly if they fall into the hands of terrorists. So I think it's important to bear that in mind and bear in mind that, again, most countries around the world, the vast majority of countries around the world, have agreed that they will not acquire nuclear weapons. They are non-nuclear weapon states under the NPT. The basic bargain of the NPT is that the five nuclear weapon states that are in the NPT, US, Russia, China, France, and the UK, will steadily pursue nuclear disarmament to reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons over time. And so the goal is to have that, as we say, peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. I will say also that we have some states that are outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty system, and India and Pakistan are examples. North Korea, another example. They were actually signatories of the NPT in 1994. They announced their intention to withdraw from the treaty. Ever since then, we have been trying to get them back to return to the treaty table and to be back in good, basically in good stead, as I said, with their NPT treaty responsibilities. So it's an important thing to remember that fewer than 10 countries in the world have nuclear weapons, and that it is the vast majority of countries that are non-nuclear weapon states that make up the great part of the international community.
Rose Gottmuller is the U.S. Undersecretary of Arms Control. She spoke and answered questions from students at the Hinckley Institute of Politics a few weeks ago. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Currently, 9 countries possess more than 16,000 nuclear weapons. The United States and Russia maintain roughly 1,800 of their nuclear weapons on high alert status, ready to be launched within minutes of a warning. Most are many times more powerful than the atomic bombs dropped on Japan in 1945. So a single nuclear warhead, if detonated on a large city, could kill millions of people, with its dangerous effects persisting for decades. Rose Gottmuller, who is the U.S. Undersecretary of Arms Control, says the failure of nuclear countries to disarm has heightened the risk that other countries, or even terrorists, will acquire nuclear weapons. Gottmuller spoke and answered questions a few weeks ago at the University of Utah.
Who's next?
Hi. Please. Welcome to Utah. I'm Chris Meekham, and I'm part of the Utah campaign to abolish nuclear weapons, and we've been working on this issue for quite a few years now. And we
have been
very supportive of the CTBT, writing letters to our senators, meeting with their aides, getting a little discouraged that we're not getting too far. Here's my concern, though, currently. We were so moved by President Obama's vision of a world free of nuclear weapons. But at the same time, what we understand is that there is now a budget, possibly to the tune of $1 trillion by its time it's all said and done, for basically replacing our Cold War obsolete arsenal of nuclear weapons with new weapons. And this seems to be kind of a contradictory effort going on, and I hate to see President Obama's legacy actually being leaving this budget to basically renew our nuclear weapons. Could you speak to that a little bit?
I will be very happy to speak to that topic because there have been some misapprehensions through reporting in various news outlets about exactly what this administration is trying to do with the budget for the nuclear enterprise and for our nuclear arsenal. Part of the president's Prague speech was a very important line, which is, as long as nuclear weapons exist in the world, the U.S. nuclear arsenal must remain safe, secure, and effective. That means that we cannot unilaterally disarm. We must continue to bear in mind what other countries like Russia and China have, what countries like India and Pakistan might have, but continue to reduce and eliminate, to press hard to get those numbers down. And we are doing so. At the height of the Cold War, this country had 31,000 nuclear weapons. And today, through steady elimination, we are down to 4,800 nuclear weapons. That's still too many. It's way too many. I agree with that. But nevertheless, you can see that the trend line is down, and it will continue to be so. But the nuclear enterprise that was built up, starting with the Manhattan Project, produced enormous facilities that were not built with any notion of environmental security or worker safety or anything else in mind. And they are enormous. They have an enormous footprint. And so what we are trying to do now in this budget for the nuclear enterprise is to shrink the footprint of our nuclear production capability, not production capability, but maintenance capability, to be able to maintain a much, much smaller stockpile over time. And the example that was raised in the New York Times was the Kansas City plant, for example, which does not produce nuclear components. It produces non-nuclear components for our nuclear warheads. It was an enormous sprawling plant that was built during World War II, again, environmentally not sound from a worker safety perspective, not very sound. So they were able now to shrink the size of that facility and build a new facility that is very small and efficient and designed to maintain a much smaller arsenal. So that is the point overall. It's the same with the science-based stockpile stewardship program. It is designed to maintain the safety, security, and effectiveness of a much smaller arsenal of nuclear weapons. When New START, the treaty that I negotiated, is fully implemented in 2018, we will have 1,550 deployed nuclear warheads. That is the smallest number of nuclear warheads we have had deployed since about 1958. So the numbers are coming down very, very steadily, and we want to continue that process. We put an offer on the table with the Russians to proceed to a further reduction that would take us down to approximately 1,000 deployed nuclear weapons. Again, that is too many. The president has been clear about that, but we need to keep that step-by-step process going. But in the meantime, as long as they exist, I really think, for one thing, you know, it's not good for our environment to be maintaining these huge, sprawling nuclear plants. Some of you may be very familiar with Rocky Flats, which was our plutonium production facility in Colorado. Huge, sprawling plant, and I was at DOE in 1997 to 1999 when it was being shut down and cleaned up. And I'm happy to see nowadays that it's kind of being considered a nature reserve, although not one where you really want to wander around too much just yet, I assume. But nevertheless, it's good to see that we're able to shutter those plants, to close them, and then to clean them up. That's where we need to be. And it takes an enormous amount of money. So that's where those budgets are going.
All right. Jonathan Rossi, I've got a double major in political science and international studies. My question for you is, countries such as North Korea, Syria, and Iran see having a nuclear program as essential for their defense and as well as their industrialization. So what are we going to do to convince them to not follow through with their nuclear ambitions?
Those are all three very different cases. In the case of Iran, we actually have a very, very active negotiation going on now, so-called P5 plus one negotiation. So we are involved in it, but also UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany, and the EU, all at the negotiating table with the Iranians. It's been a very intensive negotiation over the last year, and it's now coming to a culmination. In the third week of November, November 24th, we are supposed to get some results in this negotiation. I hope that we will get to a successful result, and I can see that the technical building blocks are in place for that. However, it is also true that the Iranians are going to have to do some tough political heavy lifting in Tehran to get to some conclusion. So I think in that case, what has convinced them is the very very heavy burden of sanctions, economic sanctions, that have affected their economies very significantly and brought them to the negotiating table. So I think that they have decided that one way or another they need to solve this problem. So now we're going to see what the result of the negotiation is. In the North Korea case, I wish I could say that it has produced some burst of industrialization, but that is the quintessential military-industrial complex. That country pours all of their scant resources, it seems to me, into their military, and in particular, in this case, into their nuclear establishment. So it's not like I think there was some magnanimous decision that this would lift all boats in North Korea and create a kind of vibrant commercial economy. It's quite the opposite, industrial economy. It's just not the case as I see it. It's been a dominant factor there. And to my mind, it has been to the detriment of the North Korean people overall. And Syria, a third case deeply in the midst of civil war. And again, I think that that situation has been one that has been very fast-moving and interesting. I worked on the program to remove chemical weapons from Syria over the last year, and we removed 1,300 tons of chemical weapons from Syria in a big international project that involved the United Nations, Russia, United States, and a host of other countries, including our partners in Europe who were quite active as well, Denmark and Norway. And, you know, in that case, obviously in the midst of a civil war, we were able to convince the Assad regime that it was a good decision to give up their chemical weapons. And their nuclear program was, you know, really just a much less developed program, I would say. So each of these three cases is very, very different. And so I guess I'm arguing with your hypothesis is what it comes down to. But thanks for the good question. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Hello, I'm Adam Brock. I'm a material science engineer, but I'm liking political science, so I may switch.
Good.
My question, I'm hoping it's not too speculative, but the goal you seem to be going for is absolute disarmament over everything, or the entire world, basically.
Nuclear disarmament.
Nuclear disarmament, mm-hmm. Sorry, I misspoke. To me, it seems like it sets up a paradigm for another arms race, you know, a different paradigm, a different way in the future where everyone has no weapons and you get the situation with breakout capability, which is basically the ability for something like, say, Japan right now, which has a very large nuclear for energy and has the ability in a short time to go for nuclear weapons. In the future where no one has nuclear weapons, doesn't this create a situation where if one country decides it wants to break the rule, everyone rushes and scrambles to create nuclear weapons to get back on that footing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. That's the question of latency, what we call the question of latency. As a policy person working in this area, I tell you, I think that's a problem I'd like to have if there were no nuclear weapons in the world, because it is a situation in that case where you have, if, you know, we cannot put the nuclear knowledge back in the bottle. The knowledge of how to create nuclear weapons is very, very well established around the world. But on the other hand, the resource investment to build up a nuclear weapons program, to have the fissile material available to do so, to develop the technical capacity to make a workable nuclear bomb, it takes a number of resources, and there are a number of signs and signals that we can see. That's how we came to know that Iran, we believe, is working on a nuclear weapons program, because they built so many centrifuges to enrich nuclear material that we said, whoa, that's way too many for a peaceful nuclear power program. It was one of the very evident signs and signals we had. So I think the situation you talk about would be a situation in which we would have a good warning if suddenly there was going to be a breakout. And so we would have to be very alert and very knowledgeable about what everybody was doing in their nuclear power programs and so forth. We already have the seeds of that system in the way that the International Atomic Energy Agency conducts its safeguards program. And so we have some opportunities to keep track of countries around the world with peaceful nuclear power programs and ensure they're not stepping over the line into military nuclear programs. And I think that would be a situation, if we get to zero nuclear weapons around the world, where we would have to have a strengthened and very capable system of, we already do, but even more strong system of nuclear safeguards. So I think, as I said, I think that's a problem I would like to have. But it's an excellent question, because we do worry about latency and whether there would be problems with, you know, nuclear breakout. So, again, thank you very, very much. Really excellent discussion.
Yes, please join me in thanking our guest for an excellent and informative forum.
Thank you.
Rose Gottmuller is the U.S. Undersecretary of Arms Control.
The rusty wire that holds the cord that keeps the anger in. Gives way and suddenly it's day again.
This has been the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. All of our programs are also available on our website and on iTunes. And you can also follow this program on Twitter @KCPW Hinckley. I'm Ross Chambliss. This is KCPW.